Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, September 4th, 2020. Section A. Local politics. Mayor. City parting ways with city manager. By Stuart Doreen. S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HearstNP.com. A community without a superintendent apparently will be without a city manager soon. The City of Midland has reported that it is working with City Manager Courtney Sharp in planning for his next step in life and career. Sharp came to Midland from the city of Mount Pleasant in 2008 and brought stability to the office after the city parted ways with then-City Manager Rick Menchaca. Sharp most recently has dealt with health issues. We have been working with Courtney in conversation and planning for his next step in life and career, as well as the city's next steps and needs for the future, ultimately settling on mutually beneficial directions with our desire to bless him for his 12 years of amazing service to Midland and our best wishes and blessings in his new journey, Midland Mayor Patrick Payton wrote Thursday. Sharp came to Midland when it was on the verge of one of its most explosive periods of growth. Midland's population increased from around 111,000 in 2010 to 145,000 this year, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. His office carried out council initiatives to build the 59-mile water pipeline to T-Bar Ranch, tens of millions in road projects, and the tens of millions spent in infrastructure improvements to allow for growth in Northeast Midland. Sharp's office has overseen the most significant efforts to redevelop downtown in decades with the building of the Bush Convention Center, the adjacent Centennial Park, a new municipal court building, and a pair of downtown parking garages. City leaders also spent about $10 million on upgrades to the city's water parks and millions more on a new Dennis the Menace Park in central Midland and auxiliary fields at the Scarborough Sports Complex. Sharp's expected departure means that it is likely that both the city and school district will be looking for new chief executives. The school district is currently going through termination proceedings with Superintendent Orlando Riddick. Local. MDC seeks new project director. By Stuart Doreen. S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HearstNP.com. The Midland Development Corp. is looking for a new director of project development. The MDC reported Thursday that current director Gary Law is leaving the Development Corporation for another opportunity in Central Texas. This position is for an experienced, energetic, and self-motivated professional to oversee Midland Development Corp's programming development and administration of infrastructure projects according to the job description provided by the MDC. Employees at this level establish their own work plan and priorities to meet set objectives. Duties include directing the coordination of project planning and oversees project development and design and preparation of construction plans, coordinating as needed with government officials, corporate officials, and the public, serving as a project manager overseeing consultants performing advanced and complex engineering work, serving as project manager to administer site improvement, building, and infrastructure construction contracts, and negotiating fees and budgets, develops and negotiates scopes of work, negotiates contract work schedules, and negotiates other contract agreements. Law was an integral part of the formation of Priority Midland and worked on projects related to infrastructure, including Loop 250 projects, projects related to Priority Midland, and those that required communication with the Texas Department of Transportation, where he once worked. Law was paid a salary of $145,000, according to MDC officials, but the salary for this position will be dependent on qualified applicants' work experience, education, and skill level, according to the job description. Local. Peyton. Future is filled with hope. Mayor discusses state of city during the Chamber of Commerce's annual meeting, by Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. Midland Mayor Patrick Peyton, in his first State of the City address, delivered a message of optimism to residents suffering a double blow from the coronavirus and oil downturn, and said the future is filled with hope and could literally be historic. His address was given during the Midland Chamber of Commerce's annual meeting after former chair Wesley Bounds passed the reins to the new chair, Chad McAllister. Peyton began by recounting when he was campaigning for mayor last summer and the apprehension some people expressed that an oil bust might happen soon. There were some of you in the room who said, "Now get ready, it's going to go south one day," he said. "But you didn't know how south. You didn't know it was going to be this south. You just thought the whole industry would change again." He said Midlanders are well informed on the state of the oil industry and their businesses. "And for those looking for the light at the end of the tunnel, I am here to tell you today, the only light at the end of the tunnel is us. If you look back on who we are, every time we are confronted with a challenge, every time we are confronted with what's impossible, every time another haymaker comes our way, every time the world and this country says it's over for Midland, Texas, we get up and we come back even better." Peyton said he's optimistic about the future because he believes residents' values, love for one another, and patriotism will help them overcome any setback this city faces. A large portion of Peyton's speech focused on the importance of the oil and gas industry. He said he's built a coalition of energy city mayors from other energy-producing regions, such as North Dakota, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere in Texas, to advocate for the oil industry in Washington, D.C. Peyton also discussed other hallmarks of this year, including the one-year mark of the mass shooting in Midland and Odessa, President Donald Trump's visit to the Permian Basin, tense conversations about the changing of Robert E. Lee High School's name, and protests of perceived police brutality. He thanked Councilman John Norman for being vocal about existing racial barriers in Midland and said residents will continue to do better. Peyton finished his speech by talking about Centennial Park, which will open next to the Downtown Convention Center in a few weeks, and said the park is a symbol of the city's bright future. "Our future is strong, it is filled with hope, and it will be historic because of who we are and what we'll do." Local and state news. Pro-Trump paintball shooter in Portland reportedly is Midlander, by Amy Green from theoregonlive.com. The pro-Trump man, who is said to have shot a paintball during a clash with demonstrators in Portland, Oregon, is alleged to be from Midland. A woman who says she was injured by a paintball fired by Alan Swinney during the clash between right-wing and opposing demonstrators in downtown Portland last month has filed a $250,000 lawsuit against him. Swinney's Twitter page says he lives in Midland. In her lawsuit filed Monday, Meg McLean said she was observing the rally next to the Multnomah County Justice Center on August 22nd when Swinney intentionally shot her, leaving a large red welt and circular injury to one of her breasts. Swinney couldn't be reached for comment Tuesday. About 300 people attended the rally to support President Trump and police or to counter protest. Supporters of the conservative group Proud Boys, as well as the left-leaning Black Lives Matter and Antifa movements, were all present. Swinney, who has described himself on social media as a conservative and a Trump supporter, was photographed by the Black Lives Matter protesters and then seen shooting. He also was seen pointing a firearm at the crowd, but he did not shoot. A reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting also captured video of Swinney shooting paintballs. McLean's Portland attorney, Michael Fuller, said his client immediately reported to police what Swinney had done to her, and they spoke to him but didn't arrest him. She really was there as an unaffiliated observer, Fuller said. She was just curious about what was going on. Nonetheless, Fuller said police weren't interested in arresting Swinney on the spot. It is just one of the many cases where police are seemingly showing favoritism to Trump supporters. Criminal charges have not been filed against Swinney. A Portland police spokesperson said it didn't return a question about the status of the investigation Tuesday. Brent Weisberg, a spokesman for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, said his office is investigating the case. The August 22nd clash lasted for several hours, with demonstrators on either side shouting, throwing rocks and bottles, unleashing pepper spray or mace, and dueling with fists as Portland police mostly stood back. Hours later, Police Chief Chuck Lovell told reporters at a news conference that officers didn't want to escalate the situation. When you interject yourself as the police in this volatile mix, sometimes it has a worse intention or worse outcome than what was happening initially, he said. This suit includes a social media post that it states was written by Swinney, who has a history as an irresponsible gun owner who travels to Oregon to organize substantial and purposefully violent rallies and events. The post included in the lawsuit reads, in part, "Ha ha, one of the terrorists is crying to Portland police about getting hit by a paintball. If they think I'm going to turn myself into an angry mob, they are insane. They are insane. Lot. LOL. The lawsuit was filed in Multnomah County Circuit Court, along with Fuller. Portland attorney Kelly Jones is representing McLean. Coronavirus cases decrease even more, by Stuart Doreen, Doreen, at HearstMP.com. For two straight weeks, the number of coronavirus cases has dropped below 200. On Friday, there is a chance to set a new low bar. The lowest weekly total since the coronavirus began to spike was 121 on June 14th to 20, while totals during the past 2 weeks dropped below 200, the notion of dropping below 121 was unexpected. Today, that might be accomplished. The Midland Health Department reported 14 new cases on Thursday for a four-day reported total of 97 cases. That is 26 behind the total 1 week ago and still 24 cases short of the 121 cases from the June date. And because the number of cases on both Wednesday and Thursday were 23 or fewer, it is likely there could be the fewest number of cases since mid-June. Thursday's new cases are reflective of lab results from Wednesday, the health department reported. The statistics from Thursday's report also shows there have been 1,745 recoveries during the pandemic and 1,343 active cases. Also, there have been 73 COVID-19-related deaths, according to the city. The opinion page. Nation's poll worker shortage is a brewing crisis. With 2 months until Election Day, the U.S. faces a shortage of one critical resource, poll workers. Thanks to the threat of COVID-19, many of them, especially seniors, will likely stay home. Without sufficient staffing at polling stations, voters may have to wait for hours before casting their ballots or see voting sites closed altogether, a prospect that risks disenfranchising people in low-income communities hit hard by the pandemic. According to voting rights advocates, the country needs at least 250,000 new poll workers to handle the expected demand for in-person voting. Meeting that goal requires immediate action from election officials. That includes boosting poll worker pay, expanding recruitment drives aimed at younger volunteers, and encouraging state agencies to give workers time off to serve. Even before the pandemic, the country's supply of poll workers was dwindling. More than two-thirds of jurisdictions reported difficulty recruiting enough staff in the 2018 midterm elections, which involved more than 600,000 poll workers. To fill these needs, local officials draw heavily from older citizens and retirees who have time to get trained and work all-day shifts on election day. Of those who served in 2018, 57% were over the age of 60. The coronavirus has made this demographic imbalance a crisis. During this year's primaries, concerns about infection caused waves of volunteers to back out, forcing election officials to close polling stations. In Milwaukee, which reduced polling places from 182 to 5 for April's presidential primary, voter turnout declined by 8.6 percentage points. By making in-person voting less accessible, the dearth of poll workers could swing the outcome in closely contested states. Advocacy organizations like More Than a Vote, an initiative targeting black voters and led by LeBron James, are trying to raise awareness about shortages and jumpstart recruitment. Another group, Power of the Polls, is promoting a web portal that helps volunteers sign up and connects them with local election boards. These efforts are welcome, but given the urgency of the situation, policymakers need to go further. States should consider offering bonuses for those who work in high-volume polling stations, for instance. Age restrictions should be eased to allow high school students who pass a training course to work as pages and provide logistical support. And state agencies should grant government workers paid administrative leave to train and serve, as a measure approved by Florida earlier this year does. Congress needs to do its part, too. The House has passed a $3.6 billion package to help states prepare for the election. That, among other things, would help cover the cost of protective equipment for poll workers. Republicans in the Senate should drop their resistance and approve the funding. It's the least they could do for those willing to risk their health to help their fellow citizens vote. Trump campaigns against himself. A commentary by Kathleen Parker from the Washington Post Writers Group. President Donald Trump seems to be running so utterly against himself now that it's almost unnecessary for Joe Biden to do much, which partly explains his many helpful months in his bunker. It is not as though Americans need to get to know Biden, who has been in public office since he had baby teeth, nor, for that matter, do we need any more exposure of Trump. Still, the upcoming debates, scheduled for September 29th, October 15th, and October 22nd, may reveal qualities or defects that only face-to-face combat can expose. Then again, voting starts in some states next week, and those showdowns are nearly a month away. Both Trump and Biden have lately offered glimpses into their pregame psyches during For Trump, an interview with Fox News' Laura Ingraham, and for Biden, a short speech about the police killings and subsequent destruction of private property in some cities. While Biden said all the right things at the right time, Trump said all the wrong things, as is his instinct and custom. Biden has a thick tongue most days, but Trump's is made of tin. The president undoubtedly expected to play softball with Ingraham, who has been a quasi-advisor to the White House for the past few years, among other things brokering the appointment of White House counsel Pat Cipollone, whom Ingraham describes as her spiritual mentor and godfather. Trump and Ingraham are close, in other words. But Ingraham is no one's best friend when the camera rolls. She pushed back when Trump began speaking in white code about bad people who live in the shadows and pulled Biden's strings. Ingraham, What does that mean? That sounds like conspiracy theory. Dark shadows. What is that? Trump. People that you haven't heard of. There are people that are on the streets. There are people that are controlling the streets. We had somebody get on a plane from a certain city this weekend, and in the plane it was almost completely loaded with thugs wearing these dark uniforms, black uniforms with gear and this and that. They're on the plane. That made me wonder, what? Who's on what plane? And black uniforms? Were they ninjas? Art gallery owners? Publishing executives? Sounds like everyday New Yorkers in their native garb. Things got interesting when the subject turned to female voters, who are now, by and large, so lopsidedly against Trump that he is trying to scare them into voting against Biden. They talk about the suburban woman, Trump said, though he did not say who they were who had been talking to him about them. They want security. They want safety. They have to have safety. So Trump blamed the protests and the riots on Biden, even though, wait for it, Biden isn't the president and has been living in his basement most of the year. Biden won't stop the riots if elected, Trump said. He's really weak, and he's not controlling anything. Who is in control? People you've never heard of, Trump told Ingram. Trump insisted that he has helped suburban women by nixing an Obama-era regulation that required some suburbs to add low-income housing to their housing mix. He was likely referring to mixed-income communities, which social engineers decided a decade ago would benefit all by allowing poor people to expand their job search networks beyond the urban core. The engineers also hoped that exposing people who are less privileged to those who are more privileged would lead to higher levels of accountability to established norms and rules, followed by increased order and safety. Anyway, many of the more privileged people apparently weren't consulted on this idea. Trump, the former developer who likes gold interiors whenever he can get them, rolled back the engineers' plans. If Biden gets in, he added, the stock markets will crash. As sure as you're sitting there, your 401ks will go down. Trump even likened the problem of disproportionate police violence against black and brown citizens to, and I'd like to give everyone a moment to sit down here, to getting the yips in golf. Trump said that the cops sometimes choke, shooting the guy in the back many times, likening it to a good golfer choking and missing a 3-foot putt. Simple as that. Where the incumbent president can't get through a relatively friendly interview without dropping ridiculous, racist conspiracy bombs or adding fuel to the flame of racial unrest, Biden can afford to tickle his own funny bone and muse to his audience, hey, do I look like a radical socialist who has a soft spot for riots? Really? Actually, old Joe from Scranton looks more like a socialite who ought to be yachting somewhere off Newport, sipping a Monte Carlo and keeping an eye out for the reigning starlet of his day, Ann Margaret. I suppose it could be amusing were Trump to say, come on, do I look like a racist authoritarian with a soft spot for fascists? Why, come to think of it, Mr. President, yes, you do. Obituaries and death notices. Carolyn Jean Cannon, 69, passed away unexpectedly on September 2nd. She was born on August 19, 1951, in Midland. She is survived by her daughter, a sister, and 6 brothers, and numerous nieces and nephews. A funeral service will be held Saturday, September 5th, at St. Stephen's Catholic Church at 11 a.m. Rosary will be held at 5:30 p.m. Friday, September 4th, at Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.mpwelsh.com. Mike Higgins, also known as Uncle Mikey, aged 53 of Midland and Coleman County, passed away on Monday, August 31st at Hendrick Medical Center in Abilene, with his lovely family by his side. A funeral service celebrating his life will be held at 4 p.m. Saturday, September 5th, at Stephen's Funeral Home in Coleman. Paulette Polly Wren, 75, born September 5th, 1944, passed away August 27th at Midland. A private family graveside service will be held in Bakersfield, California, at a later date.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Friday, September 4th, 2020. Section A. ECHD Board readies for tax hike. Public meeting is September 10th on 46.9% increase. By Laura Dennis. Ector County residents may share their views on a coming tax hike by attending a public meeting at 5:30 p.m. September 10th at the Ector County Hospital Board Room at 500 West 4th. The hike is an increase of 46.9% for Ector County residents. An average homestead in 2019 was valued at $171,164 and was taxed by ECHD at a rate of $0.112720 or $193 per year. That same home, due to rising appraisals, would be worth about $188,046 this year and would be taxed at $0.15000 or $282 per year. That's a 46.9% increase. Board President Don Hallmark said he voted yes on the proposed rate and said hospital management has done everything they can to keep Medical Center Hospital afloat, including layoffs, furloughs, and pay cuts. We lost $40 million in April alone in elective surgery, Hallmark said, adding that the COVID-19 pandemic has crippled hospitals across the country due to restrictions on elective surgeries. Hospital CEO President Russell Tippin said MCH is now in the day that was never supposed to come. Sales tax was always supposed to offset the ad valorem tax. But when the economy slows down and the governor shuts down the state of Texas for 30 plus days, it puts this hospital district in a tough situation. Who would have ever thought that we would see both of these rates declining so fast? Information supplied by the hospital district details that in 2019, that property tax brought in more than $18 million, and that in 2020, it will bring in more than $24 million. Sales tax in 2018 brought in more than $51 million and more than $54 million in 2019. This year, the projected sales tax revenue for MCH is $40,305,855. That shortfall, paired with the loss in revenue from not being able to do elective surgeries for months, is crippling MCH, Hallmark said. Tippin said he knows taxpayers will be unhappy, but that the bottom line is the county hospital must be funded. MCH will have a $14 million shortfall this year. MCH cannot pick and choose our patients. We are mandated to take care of all who come through our doors, regardless of their ability to pay. He said COVID has hit MCH on three fronts: lower patient volume and no elective surgeries, lower sales tax, and lower oil and gas prices. MCH board members Hallmark, Wallace Dunn, David Dunn, Mary Lou Anderson, and Richard Herrera, and Ben Quiroz all voted for the proposed tax rate and hearing, and Bryn Dodd voted against it. The rate is the highest rate MCH can ask for, 0.15 cents per $100 valuation. The rate is not enough to force an election to ask voter approval of the rate, but they are required to hold a public meeting. Hallmark said he stands behind the management of the hospital and that all employees are taking cuts. You can only do so much somewhere. There has to be money, and we will still be short, he said, adding that if someone has a better idea, I would like to hear it. He said the board sees less money in the future. We have to ask how long is this going to last, Hallmark said, of shutdowns. He said management has done all that could be done, plus a little more. I can't imagine a better team in management. They are doing everything possible, and they all took a cut. Hallmark also said Alpine's hospital has filed for bankruptcy and wonders who will be next. Our outlook is not as dire as those smaller hospitals. I am concerned for Crane, McCamey, Alpine, and Rankin. Shelton Gives Nursing Home Update by Michael Merlot. County Commissioner Eddie Shelton gave an update regarding local nursing homes on behalf of the Ector County Health Department during a Thursday hospital briefing. He added that the county conducted COVID-19 tests at Deering's Nursing and Rehabilitation Thursday. Shelton detailed that Buena Vida Nursing and Rehabilitation reportedly has had 76 cases of COVID-19, including 50 active cases, 22 recovered cases, and 4 COVID-19 related deaths, he said. Courtyards Assisted Living and Memory Care has had 7 cases with 1 active case and 6 people recovered from the virus. Deering's Nursing and Rehabilitation has reportedly had 92 cases with 55 active, 26 recovered, and 11 COVID-19 related deaths. Focused Care at Odessa has had 23 total cases, he said. 1 case is active, 18 cases are recovered, and 4 COVID-19 related deaths. Parks Senior Living reportedly has 2 active cases and 2 recovered cases. Shelton also said that the county is looking to buy a testing machine for COVID-19 and other viral illnesses for the health department. Medical Center Hospital President and CEO Russell Tippin said that 1,371 people have tested positive in total. 28 COVID-19 patients are in the hospital, 18 are on 8 central isolation unit, and 10 are in the critical care unit with 4 on ventilators. Of the in-hospital patients, Tippin said 3 patients are from the Buena Vida Nursing Home, 4 are from Deering's, 3 are from Siena, 1 is from Encompass Health Rehabilitation Hospital of Midland, Odessa, 1 is from Courtyard, 1 is from Crane, 1 is from Kermit, and 1 is from Pecos. 12 tests are pending, Tippin said. Odessa Regional Medical Center Hospital Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohit Saravanan said that ORMC has had 415 total positives, 2,401 negatives, and 3 tests are pending. 6 patients are in the hospital, 4 are local and 2 are from out of town, he said, adding that 2 of those patients are on ventilators. The Ector County Health Department website detailed Thursday that out of 4,323 total COVID-19 cases in the county, 2,876 cases are confirmed positives, 1,447 are probable positives, 693 cases are listed as active, and 260 tests are reportedly pending. Ector County reportedly has an 18.3% positivity rate. 3,557 people have recovered from the virus, and 73 Ector County residents have died from COVID-19 related complications. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Texas, 625,347 confirmed, with 5,107,503 tested. Total Texas deaths, 13,091. U.S. cases, 6,087,403 total confirmed, and 185,092 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.ux or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. ECISD reports 4 new COVID cases. Ector County Independent School District reported 4 new positive COVID-19 cases Thursday. They are an Odessa High School employee, a Permian High School student, a Zavala Elementary student, and a Dowling Elementary student, virtual learning only. That makes a total of 52 total cases since August 5th in ECISD. Quick hits. National Park extends public access. The Brewster County Tourism Council and Visit Big Bend have received notice from the National Park Service that they have increased their public access areas in Big Bend National Park to include the Eastern Park Road to Rio Grande Village. With the eastern end of the park reopening, trails including the Boquillas Canyon Trail will now be available for day use. 14 trails, overlooks, and picnic areas will be open to the public with this expansion. Restrooms along the open route will also be open. This increase provides over 80 miles of roadway to drive and enjoy this unique national park. Locations within the park that will remain closed include all campgrounds and campsites, including RV areas, the Chisos Basin Lodge and Restaurant, areas for river use, backcountry trails, the Boquillas Crossing Port of Entry, and all unpaved roads except two dugout wells. The paved road to Castellon and Santa Elena Canyon will also remain closed. Brewster County hotels and businesses are ready for Labor Day weekend and continue to follow CDC guidelines to fight the spread of COVID-19. Big Bend National Park is located in Brewster County, which falls under a mandatory mask order in public places, along with group size restrictions to 5 people or the size of your household, whichever is greater. On the net, visit bigbend.com. West Texas Food Bank receives donation from Feeding America. West Texas Food Bank was the recipient of 15,000 pounds of food from Tyson Foods, Bimbo Bakeries USA, and Walmart through a partnership with Feeding America. This donation, which will provide 12,500 meals, will help those who struggle with hunger in Ector County and other counties the food bank serves. The donation consists of 10,000 pounds of protein from Dyson and 5,000 pounds of bread. Over the last 5 months, West Texas Food Bank has served more than 21,000 unduplicated individuals and distributed more than 5.9 million pounds of food. In its previous fiscal year, West Texas Food Bank distributed a total of 6.3 million pounds. West Texas Food Bank serves 19 counties, including the two largest in the state. The West Texas Food Bank is a nonprofit, non-governmental hunger relief organization. It distributes donated and purchased food to children, families, and seniors through a network of more than 80 partner agencies across 34,000 square miles of West Texas. Through its partnerships and individual donations, Feeding America the largest domestic hunger relief organization in the United States, provides food to millions of Americans through a network of 200 member food banks and 60,000 partner agencies. OPD remembers the fallen. The Odessa Police Department will pay tribute to two fallen officers, Corporal Arlie Jones and Corporal Scott Gardner, at 7:30 a.m., September 8th. This marks the 13th anniversary of their passing, September 8th, 2007, when they were killed in the line of duty while responding to a domestic violence call. The Odessa Police Department Honor Guard will place a wreath at the memorial statue on the front lawn of the police department. This wreath will be displayed Tuesday from sunrise until sunset in remembrance of the officers, and anyone wishing to show their respects is encouraged to visit the memorial during that time. There will be another observance at 7:30 a.m. next Saturday for Corporal Abel Marquez. Bonham goes into lockout. Bonham Middle School spent 30 minutes from 8:15 to 8:45 a.m. in a lockout Thursday. Lockout is the new term now used instead of shelter in place. It is a precaution the district takes when they are alerted to something happening in the area surrounding the school, a news release said. Any students and staff who are outside are brought back inside. The doors are monitored, and no one goes in or out until the situation is cleared. Inside the school, classes go on as scheduled. Thursday morning's lockout came during the morning drop-off time, and ECISD officers stayed on campus to make sure students were able to get into the building quickly and safely, the release said. Chief Communications Officer Mike Adkins said it is his understanding the incident involved a car accident nearby and a subject who fled from the scene on foot and was reportedly running in the direction of the school. The Odessa Police Department reported this to ECISD, allowing the school to take the necessary precautions, and ECISD appreciates that. The lockout was lifted when officers came to believe the person was no longer in the vicinity. End of summer market. Gardendale Flea Market, 5012 East Highway 158, Gardendale, behind Gardendale Grocery, has been scheduled from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Friday and Saturday, and from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday. Food trucks are scheduled from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Friday. Shop for clothes, decor, jewelry, crafts, antiques, and more. Visit www.facebook.com/Gardendale Flea Market. Local news roundup. Police looking to identify burglary suspects. On August 17th at about 2 a.m., a burglary occurred at La Bodega, 1201 South Grant. Investigation showed two male subjects made forced entry and stole an undisclosed amount of cash. OPD has released photos of the two males that can be seen at tinyurl.com/y4w63jzu. Anyone with information about the burglary is asked to contact Detective Jay Santana at 432-335-4964 or Odessa Crime Stoppers 432-333-TIPS and reference case number 20-0014487. Police investigating bank robbery. The Odessa Police Department is investigating a bank robbery that reportedly took place at 12:06 p.m. Thursday at Prosperity Bank, 2703 North Grandview. A news release detailed that an unknown male subject entered the bank and had handed a note to the teller demanding cash and stating that he had a firearm. The suspect then left the scene in a white SUV with an undisclosed amount of cash. At this time, no arrests have been made. The suspect is described as a white or Hispanic male, approximately 6 feet tall, medium build, wearing a dark colored cap, black sunglasses, a blue necktie, white gloves, a white long sleeve shirt, dark colored pants, and had a white mask covering his face, the release said. Anyone who recognizes the suspect or anyone with information in reference to this incident is encouraged to contact the Odessa Police Department, Federal Bureau of Investigation, or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS. The investigation continues. Man charged with theft of property. Carson Newsom, 24, was arrested on a charge of theft of property, $100 to $749, September 2nd, at about 12:54 p.m. Odessa Police Department officer Tyler Silverthorne was dispatched to Walmart, 4210 North John Ben Shepherd Parkway, in reference to a shoplifter, a probable cause affidavit said. While en route, dispatch said that the subject was running from Walmart Asset Protection south towards UTPB's campus. When he arrived, Silverthorne said he assisted in searching the sports complex on the UTPB campus. The affidavit said Silverthorne was advised that the subject was wearing a white sweatshirt and black pants. He was also advised that the subject had evaded UTPB police. Silverthorne and another officer found Newsom where UTPB placed him in custody for evading. Silverthorne said in the affidavit that he made contact with people at Walmart Asset Protection who told him that Newsom had failed to scan multiple items, miscellaneous snack food products, that had an approximate value of $129.90. Walmart Asset Protection said Newsom placed the unpaid-for merchandise inside of grocery bags and then tried to leave the store, passing the last point of sale without attempting to pay for the unpaid merchandise. Silverthorne said he observed security camera footage of Newsom selecting merchandise and passing the merchandise over the scanner while simultaneously scanning another item, then placing both items inside the grocery bags. He then saw Newsom pass the last point of sale without attempting to pay for the items that were not scanned. Walmart Asset Protection said they would like to press charges for the theft. Due to the facts and circumstances, Newsom was also charged with theft of property from $100 to $749.99. Newsom was released from the Ector County Detention Center Wednesday on bonds totaling $1,500, $1,000 for evading arrest, and $500 for theft of property, jail records show. Phase 4, coming online next week, by Ruth Campbell. Ector County ISD is set to welcome students in Phase 4 back to school Tuesday. Meanwhile, Superintendent Scott Murray said Phase 3 students started September 1st. All of those students had been participating in a virtual environment. September 1st, we welcomed our third graders, our seventh graders, and our 10th graders to our schools. We saw several thousand more kids join us in that face-to-face environment, Murray said in a media call September 2nd. Next week on Tuesday, we will welcome Phase 4 of our students. So all of our 4th and 5th graders, our 8th graders, and then our juniors and seniors. In fact, we will finally welcome the senior class physically to school next week, and we look forward to bringing all those kids back, Murray added. About 16,000 students are expected to be physically in school, with the rest virtual. High school students are largely in school for some of the week and online the remainder of the week. Because COVID-19 continues to subside a little bit in our community, this means that many of fall athletic events and other extracurriculars can begin to happen. The first day of football practice officially begins Monday, September 7th. The first game is scheduled for Thursday, September 24th, and we look forward to that experience with our football players, cheerleaders, band members. A variety of different groups of kids are involved in those experiences, Murray said. But he did issue some reminders. Each of our venues, Ratliff Stadium as well as other gymnasiums or other athletic venues, will be maximized at 50% occupancy. All participants will be required to wear face masks at all times, and then social distancing must be maintained in those venues. As long as our community follows those rules, we will continue to allow our fans to participate in those games, he said. We recognize what a wonderful opportunity it is to bring fans in to celebrate our kids and the good work that they're doing. But just a reminder to our fans and families that anybody who participates at those events must follow social distancing, and mask wearing will be required at each of those events, he added. Friday night games also will be broadcast by CBS 7, Chief Communications Officer Mike Atkins said. We're appreciative of our local affiliates for bringing that opportunity to our families. More information about that can be found on the ECISD website. Murray added that the district website also has specific information on quarantine and testing protocols. People can actually return from quarantine early if they have a test. I believe it's starting on day 7 after your exposure. If you have a test and your test is negative, then you can return before the quarantine period. But again, that is only if you have a negative test result. We require evidence of that test result. In fact, I was actually at a school 2 weeks ago where two staff members walked in with their negative test results after being quarantined for 7 days, and they were allowed to return to work, he said. If somebody is quarantined, the only way they can return earlier than the 14 days would be if they have a negative test result. We would have to have evidence of that. Again, all that is spelled out in the protocol, Murray added. White Suspended for 2 Days by Michael Merlot. Odessa Fire Rescue Chief John Alvarez said during a phone interview Thursday that he recommended OFR Assistant Chief Joey White be suspended for 2 days without pay for making controversial comments on Facebook. White's comments were responding to a Facebook post that stated, "Do you think cops should be able to shoot rioters that throw blunt objects, bricks, rocks, and water bottles at them?" White responded twice, writing, "without a doubt," and then added, "shoot to kill these mother effers." Alvarez said that Wednesday morning, White approached him before any of the information was released and said that there was comments made on social media and that he was getting negative comments on that, he said. Alvarez, White's supervisor, said that he made a recommendation of a 2-day suspension to city management. "I felt that, you know, we suspended him for 2 days. That begins today, Thursday, and tomorrow as well, Friday," he said. He said the suspension is unpaid, and he discussed options with the legal department, and that he felt the suspension would be an appropriate disciplinary action to take. "Unfortunately for our chief officer, he made a bad decision. He made a bad mistake, and it was an inappropriate comment that was made on social media, and he has since apologized. He has remorse for his actions, and we hope to put this behind us," he said. "We just want to convey our deepest apologies for the comment that was made. These comments made do not reflect on City of Odessa Fire Rescue or the city of Odessa. Alvarez said that White will be back to work Tuesday. City of Odessa Public Information Officer Devin Sanchez said in a phone interview that the city is not considering terminating White as assistant chief. Obituaries and death notices for Friday, September 4th. Sarah Frances Waller Hinson. Sarah Frances Waller Hinson passed away August 30th in Longview. She was born February 11th, 1944 in Baskin, Louisiana. She is survived by two of her three children, Sherry and Todd, three stepchildren, David Hinson, Joey Hinson, and Tracy Hinson, eight grandchildren, and five great-grandchildren. She was predeceased by her daughter, Pamela. Funeral services will be September 8th at 9 a.m. at Acres West. A graveside service will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Michael Ray Villa. Michael Villa, 26, of Austin, passed away August 29th after a selfless, fatherly, heroic act in saving the life of his eight-month-old baby boy. Recitation of Rosary will be at 2 p.m. Monday, September 7th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Mass of Christian burial will be at 1 p.m. Tuesday, September 8th, with Father Mark of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church officiating at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Michael was born April 5th, 1994, to his mother and father, Francis Madrid and Guadalupe Villa. He married Crystal Villa in 2019. Michael is survived by his wife, Crystal, daughter, Athena, son, Nikolai Hector Villa, his mother, Francis Madrid, stepfather, Luis Molina, father, Guadalupe Villa, his grandparents, Gregorio and Susie Madrid, brother, Jesus Villa, brother, Alden Villa, sister, Serenity Medina, several nieces and nephews. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send condolences to the family, please sign his guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Death notices. Ernest Sosa Alvarado, Sr. Ernest Sosa Alvarado, Sr., 74, died Wednesday, September 2nd in Odessa. Services are pending with Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Louise Jernigan Blacknall. Louise Jernigan Blacknall, 91, of Odessa, died Saturday, August 29th in Crane. A graveside service was held Friday, September 4th at Ector County Cemetery, Odessa 2 section, with Pastor Gene Collins officiating. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Angel Lavario. Angel Lavario, 27, died Monday, August 31st in Odessa. Services are pending with Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Tammy Sheila Branham Lauderdale. Tammy Sheila Branham Lauderdale, 62, of Odessa, died Saturday, August 29th. A graveside service was held Friday, September 4th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.